Web Services.
Welcome to the Cloudonaut podcast. We are your hosts, Andreas and
Michael Wittig. This podcast is about all things AWS, and here we share our insights that we gain by working with AWS on a daily basis. And this is episode number 75, and we are recording this on the end of March 29 in 2023. So Andreas, I think it's time to get started here. So what is the first thing that you learned last week when working with AWS?
So Michael, before I start with that, I want to share one big announcement. Our book is now printed. So AWS in Action, the third edition, is printed. So there are already copies on their way to to Germany. So printed copies of the book are on the way to us. And I think you can already order it on manning.com, on amazon.com, and wherever you buy your books. It might take a few days until they get shipped, but yeah, they are out now. So this is really a reason to celebrate. And we are definitely planning to make some more noise probably next week or the following week, have a release party or something like that. But yeah, the good news is AWS in Action is now available. The printed version is available. That's the very good news.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I received a call from FedEx yesterday because there's some issues with customs. So our books are waiting for, I think it's called clearance or something. So because the problem here is that as an author, you receive a certain amount of free books. So they print on the package that the value of the package is zero. Well, that's $0. But it actually is quite heavy. And so they don't believe basically what's on the package. So they have reached out to us and asked what's in there, and I hopefully cleared all these missing information for them. Let's see if they can just go through customs or if you have to pay value-added tax. I think so far we never paid value-added tax, so maybe let's see what happens this time. Yeah. Okay, Andreas.
But now to dive into the technical things. So I think one thing that we did in the past 7 days is we had a look at the security of our AWS account root users. And the reason I was thinking about the whole stuff was that recently there were news about iPhones getting stolen and the thief basically shoulder serving the victims to get the PIN code. And with that, with the PIN code and the iPhone, you then basically have access to Face ID and everything on the phone. So basically you can open all the apps that use Face ID, or at least most of them. There's some differences there. And then you get access to most of the things that are on the iPhone. And I was a little concerned about that because we were using MFA, of course, for our AWS account root users, but we used OTP for that. And the reason was that until the beginning of the year, this was the only way you could share an MFA device, a virtual MFA device, with others. And because we both need access to the root user in the account, I think this was the only way to handle that. And because of that issue with iOS, iPhones, and so on, I thought about, oh, maybe we should have a second look at that. And I know that now AWS supports multiple hardware security keys for IAM users and also the account root users. And so we have been going through the very painful process of setting up hardware tokens for all our AWS accounts. We are using YubiKeys. Those are really, I really love those devices. These are really easy to use keys that you connect via USB-C to your MacBook or with NFC to iOS, to your iPhone. And so now we're using those YubiKeys to protect our account root users. And I own two of these YubiKeys, and you own two of those keys. And we have added all those keys to the AWS account root users. Yeah, so both of us have access, and when we lose a key, we still have the other one. So I think this should be fine. Because, yeah, of course, it's important to have a backup for your key in case you, I don't know, lose it or someone gets access to that. Yeah, so I think now I'm quite happy with the results. So we have a very strong MFA for all our AWS account root users. We are not using any IAM users. We're using the AWS SSO or Identity Center for that. And with Google, I have configured my YubiKey as well. So yeah, I'm quite happy and confident that this should protect from most things. Yeah, so that's the thing. So I highly recommend using YubiKeys and use them also as the MFA devices for your account root users.
Yeah, that's a good point. And Andreas, let me ask one question, because how you handle it. So I have my backup YubiKey in my office, and I have the other one, I carry it around with me. Basically, it's on my, I think it's called the keychain, right? A physical keychain with all the keys. Yeah. Is this how you do it as well?
Yeah, I'm doing it the same way, yeah.
All right. So I was a little bit disappointed, because basically the most important services for us is AWS, Google, and also Slack. So I was a little bit disappointed that's not possible to use YubiKeys with Slack. Because I tried to add it there as well. But yeah, I mean, there's still now the 1Password OTP configured there for me. But I mean, we don't share too sensitive information in Slack, so that should be fine, right? Okay, Andreas. So that's definitely worth it. I hope so, because I spend a lot of time logging into AWS accounts as a root user and changed all of that. But it's definitely better protected now. So the thing that I learned, and I'm still learning actually, is that my task on the plate was it shouldn't be that complicated to download a large file from S3. And when I say large, I mean the maximum file size, which is 5 terabytes. So my naive assumption was that I can just use the SDK, and in my case, it's the Node SDK, and kind of get the object, and within reasonable number of seconds or minutes, the file will be on my hard disk. Turns out that that's not the case. So I calculated a couple of numbers that I want to share with our listeners, and one thing to mention here is that I measured everything on an M5CN6 extra large instance. So they are very special, and I actually used them the first time this week. So those are machines with very fast CPU cores. So they can have a clock speed of 4.5 gigahertz. That's the quickest you get on AWS. And I run the instance in Ireland, EU West 1. So keep that in mind when I share my numbers. So using the Node SDK, and if I say SDK, I mean the version 2 of the SDK, because I really hate the documentation of version 3. I can't understand them. I'm very sorry. I mean, I think I have reasonable experience using version 2, but the version 3 SDK docs, I don't get it. So it's really, I have no idea how anyone can find information there. And then even with Google, it's not really possible to find what you're looking for. So that's why I'm not very, like my default is still version 2, even though they added now this annoying warning message that they are, I think, finalizing their plans for deprecating version 2. And I think we will see how that goes. But yeah, so just to mention that, I used the version 2 SDK here. And if you just call the S3 get object method, you can download a file with a speed of 0.75 gigabits per second. And basically, that's not very quick, or that's not very fast. So that's pretty slow. If you want to transfer a 5 terabyte file using that bandwidth, you will spend, I think, a couple of, or at least a day downloading the file. So that's slow. So I looked into options, because I thought that, I mean, there is actually a way to kind of parallelize that, right? I think I used the Java SDK before, where it is possible. And I saw this in other SDKs as well. So, because S3 offers a feature that I think they call it byte range fetch. So when you download a file, you can say, okay, give me this portion of the file. And by portion, you specify starting at byte 0 up to byte maybe 1 million, and then from 1 million and 1 up to 2 million, and so on and so forth. And then you can download those files in parallel. And then you get kind of twice the speed as before. But it's not implemented in Node.js. There doesn't seem to be any reasonably updated library available that does it. There's one from AWS Labs that is, I think, 5 or 6 years old, the last commit. So, yeah, we thought, okay, let's write our own. I mean, can't be too complicated, right? And I will share the link in the chat now. Keep in mind that this is not, I haven't pushed my latest changes. So if you're interested in this, please wait on until the end of today. So I have to make my final commit here. So I wasn't able to finish it in time. Sorry for that. But it's already on my local machine. I just have to kind of fix a couple of small things that are around docs, and then I can push it. So please look at this at the end of the day. So using the parallel fetch, I basically now can configure how many parts I want to download in parallel. So for example, 16 or 32 or whatever I wish. And you can also configure the size of the parts. So do you want to have I think AWS recommends 8 to 16 megabyte parts, but also they recommend that you download it in the same part size that was uploaded. So it is a little bit contradictory, but from my point of view, this doesn't change things quite dramatically. So what I want to show you is the number. So I was able to get up to 3 gigabits per second using the version 2 SDK. And I was frustrated, Andreas, because I mean, I configured it to download, for example, 16 files in parallel. So I was expecting that I can now get up to 10 gigabits per second, so 16 times 0.75. But that's not the case. So I thought, okay, let's give the SDK version 3 a try. So I kind of restructured everything, rewrote everything, and then it turned out I can now download 3.2 gigabits per second. So that's like a 7% increase or something. So not very promising as well. And so I was disappointed, and I thought, I mean, that can't be possible, right? And so I thought, or I tried to understand what's actually going on in the SDK. It turns out lots of things are going on inside the SDK. Lots of complicated things are going on inside the SDK. So I decided to rewrite the library to use the native HTTPS request of Node.js. So nothing, I have no SDK anymore. I just make the API calls myself. And what we also did, and this was actually a hint, Andreas, that you provided, and also someone on Mastodon added this, I'm going to resolve the DNS entries myself, because there is a limit on EC2 that says a single flow, and a flow is kind of like if you access one server, like one source, destination, IP address, port combination from one machine, you are limited to 5 gigabits per second for the single flow. So what I wanted to ensure is that I have multiple endpoints on the three sides, or multiple IP addresses, so that I have multiple flows open running in parallel. So I resolve the DNS myself. I get back a couple of IP addresses from AWS. I make sure that I kind of round robin through them, and I update them every couple of seconds, so to make sure that if they change anything on their side, I'm still getting the latest IP addresses. And with all those changes, I'm now able to download with 6.5 gigabits per second from Amazon S3. And with 6.5 gigabits per second, it still takes 2 hours to download a 5 terabyte file, which is still super slow. But it seems to be the maximum that's possible with Node.js, because what I see from kind of the performance tools and the monitoring and profiling tools is that the event queue of Node.js is at 100%. And I have no idea how I can make the code even more optimized, because I think there's nothing in there that could be striped out. So I'm it's kind of game over for me here, Andreas. So I'm not able to get it any faster. I can quickly double this number to 2 at 2 times by starting 2 Node.js processes. But this really doesn't help me, because I have to orchestrate and make sure that, because they write to the same file on my disk, right? I mean, I have to add a couple of or a bunch of additional logic if I need multiple processes to actually do the work. So for a single node process, this seems to be kind of the maximum that's possible. And I was a little bit disappointed, to be honest. So yeah, that's my findings. So if you're really interested in pumping large amounts of data through a process, probably Node, and definitely not the AWS SDK for Node.js is a good choice. So keep that in mind. So we haven't yet decided, Andreas, really what we do. So for now, we just leave it as it is. We might have to switch to a different language, actually, or we just keep the limitation and it takes 2 hours.
Mm. Yeah, so what I find quite interesting is that there's an SDK, AWS SDK, used by thousands and thousands of developers, and there's actually no way built in to efficiently download an object from S3. This is really crazy, because I think, how many people do that every day? How many people write that into their code? And this is just the most inefficient method to download something from S3 is the thing that is implemented in the SDK.
So I mean, the interesting part is that there is an uploader, a multi-part uploader. Mm-hmm. So the upload part is kind of implemented.
but by the way, as far as I've seen in version 3 of the AWS SDK, this is no longer the case. There's no uploader available for it.
There's an extra library. So I saw that. There's an extra library. I mean, you have to find it. Definitely a challenge because it's not part of the docs. But I found something by Googling something, and just by accident I discovered this. I think a lib storage is it. It's called lib storage or something.
Okay.
So very obvious that you have to search for lib storage to find it. But
Of course. Yeah, version 3 is really a nightmare. The documentation, at least. So Mike, seems like an easy task to download large files from S3, but it turns out there's a lot.
took me a week, Andreas. Great progress here.
At least we have an open source project now, so it hopefully helps others as well. And maybe others have an idea how to improve it. So if you have one idea, feel free to open issues, pull requests, and so on. We are really looking forward to improve that even further. Okay. So Michael, so the last topic for today is something, so it's maybe, I would say it's definitely a niche topic on AWS, but it's one that that I run into. And it's about this video live stream that is currently running. Because we have shared our video and audio setup a few times, but I think the most important thing that we use is an Atom Mini Pro. So this is a small device that basically mixes video inputs and allows you to record the whole thing on disk and also stream the video live to, for example, YouTube or other services. And I wanted to try out to not only stream to YouTube, but in parallel also to other social networks, for example, to LinkedIn. Of course, we are active on LinkedIn, and I thought, so this might be natural to stream the video there as well in parallel. And the issue is, or basically there are two issues. First is my internet connectivity. So it will be maybe possible to have two parallel streams up and running, but it's definitely coming to the maximum throughput that I have for uploading data to the internet here in my office. And the other thing is that the Atom Mini Pro, the device that I'm using from Blackmagic, does not support streaming to more than one destination. So I was looking around and tried to find a solution for that. And first I looked around, and there are definitely software as a service providers out there that solve that exact problem. So basically you give them one video stream and they distribute it to multiple destinations. So you can buy stuff for, let's say, $50 per month. There's some services that do that out there. Okay, so that was the first thing I found. But then I was a little frustrated because, we are using it only every 1 or 2 weeks, and I don't want to have another subscription for another service. And I thought, maybe there is something from AWS that solves this problem. And I remembered that there, AWS bought a company, I think, this with a product portfolio that is called Elemental. And they have a few services related to stream and distribute and convert and all that stuff, video and audio. And I looked around, and it took me a while to figure out which of the many services fits my needs. But at the end, I found out that AWS Elemental Media Live is exactly what I'm looking for. Because what AWS Elemental Media Live allows me to do is it basically allows me to create an input. And the input is basically an endpoint that I can stream the video from my Atom Mini Pro to AWS. So this gives me an IP address, a port, and so on, and I'm just streaming my video and audio to this input. And then I can define so-called channels. And a channel basically takes one input and then distributes this input to multiple destinations. So I can add, I don't know what's the limit, but multiple outputs there. And you can even do some converting your audio and video signals into different formats, into different bit rates, stuff like that. I haven't done that. I just use the defaults that are in there because I don't understand anything about all those codecs and all that stuff. I have basically no idea what I'm doing. But what I figured out is that I can then define YouTube and LinkedIn as the outputs for my channel in Media Live. And now what you see now is basically the audio and video stream going through AWS Elemental Media Live to YouTube and LinkedIn. And so now we can distribute our podcast recording to multiple destinations. And maybe we can think about adding other channels in the future. But for now, that's really interesting. And I think what is maybe interesting to know is you're paying, of course, for the service, and you're paying it for the time that this whole video streaming setup is active. This is kind of expensive, I would say, or it depends on what you use for a comparison, but it's not cheap, definitely. And you're paying a very, very little fee for keeping the resources stopped in your account. And that's what I'm doing at the moment. I'm starting the thing shortly before we do our podcast recording, and I'm turning it down afterwards. And what I've thought about is, this is something I have on my to-do list, is to use CloudFormation to spin up all the resources from scratch every time I need them, and then really delete all resources when I don't use them, because then I can reduce those minimal costs even further. Only downside is when I delete that and recreate it, I get a new endpoint every time, which means a new IP address that I have to configure in my Atom Mini Pro device. But other than that, I think this would allow us to reduce the cost even more. And then it's really a few, I don't know, maybe a dollar for one of our live streams or something. So it's really a cheap and cost-efficient solution for doing that. And we could add, I don't know, other LinkedIn live events, for example, with your profile, or stream on Twitch as well, stuff like that. So it's possible to add as many outputs as we want, and we don't increase the bandwidth that is used from my office. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I found this is a very niche topic, definitely, but I found it interesting that there is a solution for that by AWS, and I could use it. It was not too complicated to get it up and running. I think it took me maybe 2 to 4 hours to configure everything with the Atom Mini Pro, the AWS side, the YouTube side, the LinkedIn side, and so on. I'm quite happy with that setup.
Yeah, that's cool, Andreas. And I mean, the only problem basically that still remains is finding the right AWS service for your problem, right?
Out of there's something for everything,
but you have to kind of remember, oh, this was Media Elemental Live.
definitely a challenge. Okay, Michael, I would say that's it. We will be back probably next week. Subscribe to our newsletter, podcast, or YouTube channel to make sure you're not missing the upcoming shows. And we're looking forward to your feedback. hello@cloudonow.io or find us on LinkedIn, Mastodon, and Twitter.
Yeah, you'll also find all the links in the show notes or the video description. And I think that's kind of it. Thank you very much for listening, and we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye.